In the beginning, there was a house. It had walls and a roof, windows and a door. It did not... Where's the music?
Oh,
there. I can't do this without background.
There you are. Does that feel better now?
I feel better.
Are you comforted?
I'm back home. It did not resemble other houses. That's too much music now. Get it right!
I'm trying! Okay.
It did not resemble other houses of the day because there weren't any other houses. So by default, it became the archetype of all house-like entities that followed. Millennia passed before another house appeared because the neighborhood was hot and dense in a primordial sort of way and not conducive to development. In fact, the next structure to appear was a chicken coop. It was infected with a varicella zoster virus, however, so the zoning board denied it a habitation permit.
You know, that barn across the street where our ponies are was a chicken coop.
Was it?
Yes, it was. So how nice. You're within 100 feet of a chicken coop. Right now, with virus of all kinds.
I feel much better.
You feel buggy.
Buggy. The decision saddened the house, weakening its HVAC system. So when it bid the coop adieu with the inorganic equivalent of a hug, it caught the virus. Soon thereafter, the house came down with shingles, which in the long run, of course, was a boon.
Shingles were a boon.
Were?
Shingles were boons. Wait,
boon
the coming
shingles?
Down was a boon. I don't understand your grammar most of the time. Please continue.
More millennia passed. That's a subject, predicate, and...
That one I've got.
Life forms appeared. But because the neighborhood was still hot and dense, they just as quickly disappeared. Some did, however, stop to visit the house first. No matter the door had been zoned for both entry and egress, these visitors exited by way of a window. There was no apparent reason for doing so, but then there were few apparent reasons for anything in those ancient days. Those that lived to tell the tale were called defenestrators. To be sure, the life forms that didn't survive the window departure were also dubbed defenestrators, but their story is not crucial to this narrative. Another time.
I would like to decide that.
Another time, perhaps.
Oh, all right. Another time, perhaps. All right. I can live with that.
Given the nature of the neighborhood, it was hot and dense, remember, it was inevitable that these acts of defenestration would attract spectators. Whole ecosystems sprung up whose sole purpose in life revolved around these domiciliary exits.
Sprung up?
Yes.
Did that become the past tense of spring?
It did. Spring sprang sprung, but sprung is also past tense.
It is.
Yes.
I'm learn something every day here on Calvus and Damien in the house.
In the house. Yes, I checked that because I thought, anyway.
Well,
yes.
Whole ecosystems did, in fact, spring up.
Yes. Some debated, hotly of course, whether the acts were deliberate or involuntary. Others argued over the meaning of the door, concocting elegant conspiracy theories as to why it worked solely as a one-way conduit. Still others seemed content to merely observe the defenestrations, no matter they sometimes had to wait eons for the next one to come along. Evolution was clearly still in its trial and error phase. One day... What?
It's trial and error era.
Error. Oh, error.
Error, error.
Error. Yes. I guess it could be the
yes,
error.
Yes, the error, error.
Error. One day, errors later...
Another structure appeared in the neighborhood, by any chance?
It looked quite like a house in that it featured windows and a door. However, it lacked a roof and walls. The zoning board, which at the time was packed with conspiracy theorists, debated a long time, some say more than 1,000 coops, before deciding to confer the house honorific onto it. Besides being deficient in fundamental exterior components, the new house was different from the archetype in another key respect. It made noises. In the vacuum that constituted the neighborhood, this was hard to verify, but several surviving defenestrators claimed to have heard it, plus the original house admitted to feeling something in its joists. That was proof enough for the zoning board, which promptly granted the new house a conspiracy license. Had anyone bothered to ask any of the defenestration-observing ecosystems, which had developed, along with their scrutiny skills, a keen sense of auditory sensitivity, he, she, or it would have learned that the sounds were organized. But in a good way.
Good way. Oh, I love good ways of sound.
Still more millennia passed. Or one did, anyway. The neighborhood grew less hot, less dense, and the sounds grew proportionately more organized. A chord materialized in the ether, after which harmony cautiously took root. The house reveled in this evolutionary tweaking because it was for the first time experiencing a sense of feng shui. Conversely, the structure of the harmony so discombobulated the defenestrators that they filed a grievance with the zoning board. The board went into executive session to discuss the merits of the grievance. The regular meeting site was unavailable, so the board moved its session to an Algonquin hole, which regrettably slipped through a fissure in the space-time continuum and vanished. Because the board is still missing, the complaint is still pending. Over time, the defenestrators grudgingly came to accept harmony as a viable neighborhood component. The newly welcoming climate, formerly known as the Age of Organized Noises, triggered the rapid evolution of rhythms, timbres, and tubas. In turn, whole ecosystems arose to observe these new sounds. Defenestration became a sometimes noisy event. Even the door, which had always been a silent means to enter the house, now looked forward to episodes of knocking, slamming, and jamming. Were you planning to knock, slam, or jam?
I was hoping, but it seems that our particular choice here has reached a kind of organized noise state.
Yeah.
Highly organized.
Mm-hmm.
Highly Webernian in its
smoothness.
Smoothness, yes.
Yeah.
No spiky bits.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, shall we get back to this?
Sure.
All right. Here we go.
The second house was undergoing a change as well. Even without authorization from the zoning board, it was turning the O in its name into an A. The reason for this change was not clear until even more millennia had passed. Until today, in fact, in a still different house. This house.
This house.
The house of Calvo's
Ampersand
Damien, which will soon play host to that other house and his own gang of defenestrators. Intrigued? Well, I should hope so. It isn't every day, after all, that we have more than one house.
In the house.
Do you have any idea how hard it is to find decent defenestration music?
I do now.
Yes. We couldn't... The best I could come up with was Fallen Sparrow.
You could have
by
maybe,
Barry Schrader. That's what we've been hearing in the background.
You could have played the Windows theme.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I could do that, but I won't.
Oh, okay, good.
I was thinking that I should play the theme from House.
Is there a theme?
Yes.
Can you hum it?
I can't do it with this other thing. Let me turn this down. Anyway.
Okay. And this is appropriate, of
yes,
course.
Yes, everything's appropriate here.
Not everything.
Everything.
Everything?
Yes.
Even Barry?
Even Barry.
Okay.
All right. But we're not burying today.
No,
we're housing. Our guest! You're here!
I'm here.
And you're named after a combination of buildings and spring water. Evian House.
Yes.
Evian House. That's it. That sounds very refreshing.
Evan House. Evan House. How do you like your name, Stead?
I actually, believe it or not, say Evan Haas.
Evan Haas.
I've become accustomed to not get ruffled by House because I've been hearing it that way for a long time now. So.
That would then
and it means house, so what can I say?
Ponderosa.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a whole nother essay.
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, welcome to Calvus and Damien in the house, here in the house.
Great to be here in the house.
We first met, and I was trying to think, you know, and I was sure we had met only online. And then you reminded me as you walked in the door, we'd met at the Chamber Music America in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Purely by chance. Purely because I sat down at a table at the BMI little wine thing they do.
Always wine.
At the end of the afternoon and sat down and just struck up a conversation, which is not typically my way, but I do it there. I've done it at that particular reception in another year, too, and it happened to be you. And I happened to know who you were and know about both of you, well, know about the show.
Well, see, most people met me at that particular CMA because they had to go to the bathroom,
right.
Because they positioned me right next to it.
Not next to a window,
next to a bathroom. So anyway, well, so welcome. So we, and you know, I listened to the first scenes from your opera some not too long after that, and I said, way back then, we gotta talk to you about that. So you have background. Damien has background.
Huh? What?
You brought the cheat notes from the bio.
I did?
Yes.
Oh. Tell me where they are, Dan.
I've forgotten. So, okay. Well, Evan, you tell us about yourself then.
Okay. How? Starting at what point in time?
Well,
what are the important things?
You've received recognition and praise for your opera trilogy. You could say that. We know that, but you could say it again just to confirm.
There was an article written. I was. My favorite article that was written was something that appeared on Newsday, and that was titled "Haas Music" or "House Music." I'll say now that we've gone down that path, "House Music," no conspiracy opera, a house specialty, and I appreciated that article. People that have gone to it liked it. I can't remember the very few reviews that were there that people wrote about it. I guess Opera News and the second opera. There were 9 performances, and on the last night, a reviewer actually came, and that was Leighton Kerner, and he wrote something very, very nice about it. And
we should probably explain it, just not throw this in front of our.
No,
audience.
We'll get to that because
we will?
Yeah,
we're not ready.
We're not. Well, we'll get to it. I mean, my question really is, how did you start on writing opera? Why opera? How did it's a really long chain of questions. Why that? Form? How did you get it into production? Who are the people involved? Were they friends?
The whole story. Sure,
yeah.
I'm happy to tell it.
I'd love to hear this story because we never speak to anybody who writes opera. I think the only other person was Darren Hagen.
Yeah.
He's the only other opera.
Well, that's
composer.
Very interesting because it feels like I tend to begin to notice how many people are writing operas, and usually the ones that most people haven't heard of, or both the composers and the things that they're writing. I think a lot of composers, any composer who likes to write, goal-directed music and dramatically shaped music, I think probably has an inner opera composer there somewhere, just because of the movie culture we live in and things like that, which I think is what feeds. I think we all have an instinct through that that we don't know until we begin writing something like that, a storyline with words. You're setting a script, and then you begin to realize, oh, my gosh, this is pretty – at least I felt like this – it felt pretty easy. It came pretty easy to me. How I started doing it, I certainly was not thinking about writing an opera, but I just moved to New York City, and my librettist was actually a friend. One of the few contacts I had in New York City was somebody I hadn't seen since nursery school in North Carolina. And he was somebody who has gone by many names. He introduced me to his circle, and among them was Gary Height, the librettist. And we were having a – he actually was responsible for me moving out of this garage I was living in on 3rd Avenue in Gowanus of Brooklyn. I lived there for a month, and then I got bounced out of there by circumstances, not with the other person living there, and said, you should move to Greenpoint. So I moved to Greenpoint, and unbeknownst, really by chance, he was living on the same block. I chose an apartment and happened to be the same block as he, so we socialized even more. And one night at a party that we were having with our friends, he was always thinking of this spring festival of his on the solstice called Love Sphere, which is apparently, he calls it a 69-year festival, and I think it was in his 8th year. and the theme of that festival was PSYOPs. And in that, he had his own script. He's somebody who had worked in theater for the New City and written little scripts, and he was kind of a rock musician, and he was a DJ at WKCR in the early 90s when he was a student at Columbia and things like that, and all kinds of interests. And he gave me this script called The Birth and Theft of Television. And it basically begins, Philo T. Farnsworth and Edwin Armstrong meet in a bar. And he said, would you like to do incidental music for this? And I just, in a brash, bold move, said, why don't I set the whole thing as an opera? Not knowing what that, and this was in October of 2000, and it was going to be done in March of 2001. So... it was about a 15 or 20 page script, and I did, except for one scene which I just let be a spoken scene and did sort of like a improvisation sound painting type of thing to accompany it. I did set the whole thing, and that was the beginning. It just felt right from I began very simply, and it just felt right, and then. From there, we can go on to how that became a production.
Well, yeah,
like
but
that.
let's spend a little bit more time with the music itself. Mm-hmm. How did you go about composing it? I mean, we're familiar with generally with two things, either pop songs or art songs. But opera is a larger structure, and so how do you convey not only the sort of the architecture and the shape of the script, but how do you work out the small details so they fit in a larger context? What do you as a composer go through in doing that?
Mm-hmm. I will say that as somebody who at that moment in time was very much a, you know, and still am, but coming out of a formalist, you know, sort of academic composition background and everything else, I would have had the ability to make this great complex form, but for that particular project, I immediately began. It was going to be unselfconscious and un-everything, and it was just going to be a question of getting something simply on the page that could be performed. And the way with that particular opera, that my approach was one of the formal things I remember doing was that he had had some idea of. Some visual ideas and some radio static ideas and things. So each of the scenes I began with, in place of radio static, I had the group improvise on a single pitch. And that pitch, these pitches came with polarity for each of the scenes. And so there was a key structure. That was, I guess, the extent of it. And then after that, it was just the intuitive thing that we all as composers do. You remember the lick you wrote 90 bars ago, and it comes back again, and things begin to gel. And interestingly enough, in my second opera, a guy who had a small part in the first opera heard it, and he said, I heard some of the same licks, and I never once tried to make I didn't want to be presumptuous enough to make these connections at that stage between operas. But I know what he heard, and I think it was more of a style thing, just my own things I like to do. But so the form that went on And by the second opera and the third opera, I did get more into it. I began to get more, still remaining unself-conscious, still writing through composing, but at the same time, thinking more of structure. I'm trying to think of the first opera, though, which not to get too far afield too quick, but that was the main thing formally. No, there were other things. I mean, I think a song in the second scene was basically a song, and I used that to underpin a whole different music format, something else that sort of harkened back to that. And so, in other words, I think there are subcurrents of light motives in that aren't overt, but more like near the doormat in this scene becomes this sort of poster on the wall, you know, in the background of this other scene at the right time, and maybe a chord progression or something like that. And I definitely smelled my way through it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is writing something in that short of a period of time, the compactness, I think the world, the orbit is a little bit narrower and faster around your brain. And so it does kind of spin together, I think. And,
do you write out orchestration, or do you write out something sort of compact and then work it out from there? What kind of ways do you approach how you produce the notes, really?
Right, and in the operas, it was I drew as much on my background of writing rock songs as I did writing contemporary music, and so it was a lot of sitting down at the piano, banging out chords and melody, and singing. So it is a vocal score that gets orchestrated later, and the orchestration in my operas, while the third opera, I'm very proud of the orchestration, and a lot of time went into that after that piano vocal process. In the earlier operas, it was piano vocal and just what instruments do I have and just score it.
Uh-huh.
You know? How did you know which instruments? Did you determine the instruments or did someone else?
Interesting. In the first opera, since I was new in New York and knew a few people, it was determined by what friends I knew could do it.
Yeah.
And that became no strings, all winds, percussion, and piano. And in the second opera, I thought this opera was going to be produced in the basement, or I'd say it's called the cabaret, but I call it a theater for the new city, this tiny space. And I thought, okay, this opera is going to be a string quartet and a couple singers, and I'm going to just keep it to that. And I like to call my second opera my first string quartet in a lot of ways, because it turned out to be string quartet with a bass and a flute and a clarinet and a piano. But so much of the early conception was just trying to keep it for string quartet. And I was just going to go find one. Come hell or high water, I was going to find four string players to do this. And it expanded, and it worked out as a seven-piece, you know. And then the third opera is brings both of those together into virtually just a standard chamber orchestra. And so I think maybe if I ever do the first opera again, there are actually some passages for strings I wanted. I'll probably go back and maybe give that, or maybe keep it as it is, the A and B, you know, put them together at the end. So based the first opera based on who I knew, and it was interesting because most of them were improvising musicians and who weren't looking for nor interested in doing sitting out and playing classical opera, but I got them to do it because they could do it. And therefore, there's some improvisation. I had windows of improvisation in the first opera, et cetera.
So we've jumped way into the composition stage and all, into the part of the production stage, actually. Let's take a break and listen to some music of yours, and let's go back to, you know, earlier in your career. Let's hear some early things.
Okay.
And what we'll do is then ask you where you came from and how you developed as a composer, and then we'll sort of make the architecture of bringing it back to your opera.
Okay.
Make opera of the
sure.
show.
Let me just think. Well, that would be, I actually have something that would have been a great precursor to opera, but this is actually one thing that I absolutely did not plan to play. It was a big song cycle with a chamber orchestra, and based on the text of my brother. But since me and my brother are at odds, maybe I shouldn't play it. He'll come after me for copyright. And maybe not something not vocal, since we'll probably be getting to something vocal, right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Let's have something.
Okay. Let me think here. This is called A Word Without Val's Richtival's new idea, RKJVL apostrophe S, new idea. And it is a fable for violin and marimba, in which the marimba creates the violin part, nurtures it, raises it, and then is turned upon by the violin, and the violin dispenses with the marimba at the end.
Just like real life.
Indeed, I love it. Our guest is Evan Haus. Evan Haus in the house. Thank you. Evan Haas is our guest, and that was, as I drop things here, and I'll drop it again. There we go. RKJVL's new idea.
No, you have to pronounce it.
There.
Yes,
there.
Evan Haas himself on the marimba and Nancy Cote on the violin. When did that come about? When did you write that?
That was written 20 years ago in spring of 89. I was studying in Vienna and, on a semester abroad at Oberlin with Richard Hoffman, my teacher then in that semester, and I performed the following fall, I believe, early 90 or something.
It's going to be incumbent upon us to back up to this reference to rock and roll songs and how he got to Vienna.
You don't think it was obvious?
Take us back in time on my.
Okay, so when I was a teenager, I was an active musician in my school music programs, et cetera, and my parents were musicians, were sort of the local musician. Where my father was the local orchestra conductor of the university orchestra in my town at East Carolina University. And so I was I went through a phase, especially in the ages of about 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, of heavy metal and played guitar. And I taught myself guitar. I've been a drummer since, say, I was 10, and I've been banging on our house piano since I was as early as I can remember.
The Haas piano.
Yeah,
thank you.
And then it began my teens, and I really wanted to play guitar, and I taught myself how to play. And then I had bands and did a lot of cover songs and then began to write songs. And,
what did you cover? I got to know.
Oh, my goodness. Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Ozzy Osbourne, even such unknown favorites as Saxon, Riot. Who's heard of the band Riot? It's a New York band that is a small but very devoted following.
Richie told me about Riot.
Things like that. I mean, things that were they were all over the place. I mean, I virtually ever played in front of people, rehearsed like the Dickens. That's when I knew I had a conducting future, because I was a taskmaster in the shed with my band. You know, shedding takes on a new meaning, you know. And we would play events where the last thing we wanted to hear was heavy metal, you know, such as the band pool party or something like that.
And weddings.
Yeah. And you know, keeping a hand also going to all state competitions and playing timpani and snare drum and percussion and what have you. So anyway, when Crossroads came to go to college, my parents said, if you can think of anything to do besides music, do that.
Please do
keep
that.
Music as a fun thing. And I thought for a while, and I had some idea, thought something in writing, English, be a journalist or something, and write my stories on the side or something like that. And anyway, one thing came to another, and I ended up getting a scholarship, fairly prestigious scholarship, even though it wasn't lucrative, didn't have to be lucrative. It was an in-state school, North Carolina School of the Arts, and I went there. I'd already begun composing because of going to summer music festivals like Brevard Music Center. I went to in the summers, and that's where I got turned on to the big orchestral repertoire.
Right.
And then that's when I came home and pillaged my dad's score library and began to see that, I can write and be making music at the same time. So the pencil and paper versus being creative and building things, and it all came together. And so I began composing, you know, on paper before I got to college. I probably could have gone to college as a composition major, but it was the last thing I thought was in any way useful. And I even...
And you eat to this day.
And I resisted it, even though I started immediately with a composition teacher, having hour lessons just with a man named Sherwood Schaffer at School of the Arts, who was a great teacher. And that persisted. I didn't become a major in composition until said trip to Vienna at Oberlin. They said composition majors in their junior year, second semester, can go to Vienna with, Richard Hoffman. And I really wanted to go, but I wasn't a major, so I said, can I be a major? And I signed up to be a major, and I went. And then I became a major.
So you spent a semester or a year?
A semester. And interestingly enough, I'm going back there for the first time since in about a month and a half. I'm going to stay in a hotel in the same town of Mödling where Schoenberg invented the 12-tone system. And his house is there where he was living at the time.
His Haas.
Haas. His Haas was there. His Hausa. And anyway, that semester was incredibly seminal for me because I had no sticks, no mallets, and I didn't play any percussion.
Uh-huh.
And this is when I began to write, and even more so wrote away from a piano, and it was all good. And that was the surprising thing. I got back, and I thought, and that was one of the pieces. I say this is the first piece I ever wrote away from a piano. And it was just using my inner ear, trusting it, and which where I hadn't before. And yes, there were some systems, but I did not use it wasn't a serialized system. It,
mm-hmm.
it was a kind of a freewheeling, but it was still somewhat combinatorial. But I came back, and in my last year at Oberlin, did everything, had this great, wonderful, full of activity year. And then I went to grad school as a composer because, again, laziness sets in. And I did not want to go. I didn't want to learn a big percussion thing to go and play percussion at grad schools. At that point, I said I'm just going to mail my scores and see what happens. And that's how I began grad school.
It must work much better with grad schools than orchestras. Huh? So, and you went to grad school where?
University of Michigan.
Okay, and that's big band school.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you go out there in March? Graduate marching band?
Graduate students didn't have to, for some. And I wasn't a percussionist. I was a percussion minor at that point.
Uh-huh,
it slipped
uh-huh.
over. The balance of power had shifted to writing.
And so did you do anything good while you were in grad school? I mean, we hear it's stuff that can really defeat
you.
The
great thing about grad school, and particularly that one, is that there were... I was already used to, from Oberlin, finding great performers and doing ambitious projects. Like my final thing, I'd written a chamber orchestra piece in Vienna and got these incredible musicians to play it, some of whom are the principal players in some of the major orchestras in the country now, who I didn't know. I'm not in touch with them now, but they've gone on. They're these in this little orchestra I'd put together. I also had a big 12-piece rock band at Oberlin with six-piece horns, and we would transcribe things like Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin, but I would write horn parts in place of, very Zappa-esque, even though I didn't know Zappa was doing that. It was more really influenced by The Who, who had a revival in 89 and was going around touring with big horns and everything. That was my big inspiration for that, but... At Michigan, I put together more ambitious projects. I have a chamber, for instance, I could maybe play something from the Chamber Symphony.
Yeah, let's do that.
I also have
a
big band piece, and I have an orchestra. Anyway, that one might be something to... there are a lot of things I could choose from that period, because that period is 90 to 96, so that's...
Oh, a long time in grad school.
A lot of writing and a lot of tapes. So.
We will need to sample one of your band pieces, your rock band pieces, if you have one.
Oh, goodness. Did I bring one?
I'm so
I do have
modest
something.
I didn't bring. Oh, you did.
No,
good.
I don't have.
Okay, well, we can just
talk
pretend.
About it.
Yeah. Yes.
I can definitely mail one of those in later.
Do some of the Oberlin Chamber String Band here, or whatever you got.
I wish I had some. I just actually did break down some tapes of Page One was the big band with everything. I named it that because of all the writing I had to do to get music in front of them. But that's only on my, dare I say it, my iPod and not on a CD.
Let's have a listen to what you
we
got.
We can feed that in.
Yeah.
I know we can do that. But okay, so you want to hear something from... tell me what.
Something big, something handsome.
Big and handsome.
Big, handsome
Not
music.
Not small and ugly.
No, small, ugly music. Big, handsome music.
Okay.
We're here at Calvin's Damien in the house. Our guest is Evan House, Evan Haas.
Well, why don't I give you James Brown loops, such as for two antiphonal funk bands. That's kind of a concept.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Brief. Okay. James Brown loops was written in 1993, and... the impetus for this was one of those pieces. I believe every composer either has this moment or should have a moment where there's a piece that has to be written, whether or not you want to do it or not. It sort of is screaming for someone to just put the nails in the wood and make it stand because it had to be done. And this is one such case. This would be track one, and in this case. I was vibing off of the viscerality of the opening of that big academic favorite of those years, Die Stadt by Louis Andriessen.
Andriessen, sure.
And that heavy wind and electric bass is kind of in your face, and so I thought about that. So this is two funk bands. There's no singer. Each band is a drum set and a percussionist and electric bassist and something like six or eight horns. And then it's antiphonal on either side of the stage. And I think this is only this recording, and then I did it again at a club in Brooklyn in 2004, and it was the only time, two times. Even though it's oft talked about and wanted, there's only two times it's ever been played. This is a really good recording. Some of the stereo imaging actually comes through. And there you go, James Brown Loops.
And this is where did you have this performed?
This was performed in University of Michigan in November of 1993.
James Brown Loops.
Can't you just see the University of Michigan marching band while they're doing their script Michigan on the football field? I can see this, you know. An extended percussion. No, but the band has a huge percussion section.
Yeah.
You could do that. Sure. Used to, you could hear the
you could hear the band riffs in there.
The Victors was somewhere in there.
Sure, absolutely.
I had a different idea for them one time when I was at a game. I thought, what if I gave everyone in the stands a cowbell, all 100,000 of them, and then wrote something for the marching band and wrote for that many people?
Oh, that would be so much fun.
We could get 100,000 cowbells.
Donors.
Donors, of course.
Big slaughter. So there you are. You're still running a parallel track in a sense, because you have the big influence of pop, and you have a big influence of heavy metal, rock and roll going on. Big band here, Vienna influence of the sort of modernism.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened?
Man, it's always been that. I mean, I've never. It's always been. Following my intuition, and you know, that piece is special in that it was going to be this thing. I mean, the pop influence, if you will, is going to be right there on the surface, and it's going to be right. You know, it's almost a gimmick. But I guess what happened with me is just trying to is what happens with everybody is just reconciling. Knowing too much about music history and notes and how they've gone hither and thither and the politics of them, and what you call your own blood and guts, what it is you think got you excited in the first place. I think what got me excited in the first place, going back to heavy metal, was virtuosity, like flurries, fast things, powerful things. I think drama got me was because before the rock and roll phase, there was as a little kid, I liked the film music, you know, I liked and emotion. I mean, I liked the, one of my favorite all time groups. I mean, heavy metal was the only music I liked when I was young. I was a big progressive rock fan, and Yes, I was a big Yes fan, and so
yeah, I
like,
can hear Alan White in some of your licks. Who was the drummer for?
Yes. But you know, Yes is more of an angelic group, but with great music musical complexity and great tonal and great tonal, pretty, you know, cathartic type of moments, and I love that. And you know, and I like structure. I mean, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be an architect, basically because I like playing with Legos, and so building things, and that kind of sense of wanting to build these, be formalist, is stuck with me, and so it's always a fight with coming up with these great structures, and then how long does it take me to abandon them? Because sometimes it's usually after 8 seconds. Generally, every piece of mine is a exposition of a road down, walking down the road of this big form I had preconceived, and then getting rid of it and just using that as sort of like a pool to draw from and to do what I want to do for the next. So,
sounds like you have done almost everything that you wouldn't do in the academy. I mean, was that a sort of a conscious choice, or were you just you know, it was just your background? And what was the reaction on that side of the wall?
Well, I was always around. I was fortunately around places, certainly in Michigan, where I came through the academy at a time where there's a great fostering of. I'll throw another influence for you. One of my big influences at Oberlin was Randy Coleman, who is more from the, that would be more from the John Cage, the more open form, mm-hmm. You know, non-narrative, improvisatory, what would in would be called the downtown school. I don't want to put him in any box, but he was a very influential man and a teacher for me, and so I dabbled with that a lot, and I mean, I really saw the merits and saw that was the future of music, but I had these chops to deal with too, and these things I knew how I wanted things to go, so that was a reconciliation. So I had four my big influences. My first teacher was very traditional, but very friendly, so he just straightened up a lot of things like my notation and development of a theme, and that was great. And then I got to Oberlin. And Randy was a big influence, and then Richard Hoffman was a great influence too. But you know, Richard Hoffman basically brings you Schoenberg and a great joy and sense of humor. And then I got to Michigan, and that was really becoming more of. I studied with Leslie Bassett just before he retired, You know, I really value him as a teacher for that brief period, but then Albright and Bolcom, and so there was, and their sense was to they were already rejecting the academy. They were
right,
already
they certainly were, yeah.
Yeah. So I think the folks in Michigan wanted to see people do that. I mean, it was almost like couldn't do enough of it, really, to be smart and reject the old dogma at the same time. So
see, that was my problem. I went to the wrong place at the wrong time. I was one state below you, and everything was absolutely wrong. Everything traditional and no humor and... Okay, never mind.
Uh-huh. Well, I was...
You had to burn.
Where was that?
That's the school...
Of Ohio State?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said it. He said it.
He said it.
Just to, lest I give everyone else all the credit, I'll also say that I was always stubborn with everybody, and I was always sort of like, I have this, I'm a rock musician, I can do the, but I didn't want to do right, I never wanted to write. Actually, I do have a really wacky piece from Oberlin where I tried to make this yes-like ensemble, and it was a six-piece ensemble that everyone sang at the same. It was a harp, piano, two percussion, and electric guitar, electric bass.
Oh, we need to hear this.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
In youthful pretense fashion, it's a couple minutes too long, but it's like 11 or 12 minutes long.
Perfect. Oh, perfect.
Yes. Lovely.
We're for pretense.
Okay. Well, we can. It's called E.I., and it's a poem. It's a nocturnal. It's a poem I wrote. It's a praise to night, and. And it was my idea at that time of just before I went to Vienna, literally the last thing I did before I went to Vienna my yes love of yes coming into coming onto the concert stage, and a big part of that was people had to sing and play. That's what rock musicians did. That's what I spent my teenage years doing, learning licks, playing this hard music and singing it at the same time and coordinating it all. So
Rick Wakeman never sang.
Well, yeah, he had it easy. Yeah.
Right.
No.
Let's hear E.I.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.